6/10 of a mile, according to my GPS, and the whole front end of the sled just fell apart.
Challenges along the Copper Basin 300 Trail as mushers bear down on Glen Allen. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the economic forecast for Anchorage, less grim than many have been bracing for.
We feel that we're going to probably lose fewer jobs in some of those basic sectors like oil and gas.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If subsistence is important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. Deadline to apply is Friday, February 3rd. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
A winner in the Copper Basin 300 sled dog race is expected to cross the finish line in Glen Allen sometime this evening. In the lead is Ryan Olson with just over 20 miles to go. Just a few miles behind her, clustered closely together, are veteran Alan Moore of Two Rivers, Paige Drobny of Esther, and Michelle Phillips of Canada. As KUAC's Molly Reddig reports, after bracing themselves for extreme cold at Saturday's start, mushers have encountered warmer temperatures and fresh snow on the trail.
Two Rivers musher Ryan Olson filled up water bottles at the Myers Lake Lodge about 100 miles into the race.
It's been beautiful. Can't complain. It's not the forecasted 50 below, so.
Out on the lake, the darkness was broken up by moving dots of light as mushers and headlamps fed and rested their dogs after hours of running through the night. About 20 dog teams were nestled in the snow, burrowed into snowdrifts or tucked under straw to avoid the sharp wind blowing across the lake. Olson arrived into Tulsona in second place Sunday afternoon. After leaving the start chute 30th, she had a lot of catching up to do.
On the one hand, it's nice because the dog team keeps seeing another team and they get excited and they want to go catch them and chase them.
But negotiating 24 dogs on a narrow trail can also result in tangles.
I did have a few tangles and that takes time to stop and untangle them and get going again.
As a qualifier for the Yukon Quest and Iditarod, the Copper Basin 300 brings out a wide range of experience. On Saturday morning, the streets of Glen Allen were filled with big trucks and howling dogs. Vern Halter was putting booties on his colorful team of Alaska Huskies near the start line. The 68-year-old has run the race at least 25 times. In addition to being mayor of the Mat-Su Borough, he has a lengthy mushing resume as a former Yukon Quest champion and top five finisher in the Iditarod.
I don't know if it's my last one, but, you know, I said that last year, or 2 years ago, I think it was.
Just down the street from Halter, Jennifer Labar was unloading dogs from her truck.
It's my first 300-miler, and it's my first race ever. And 11 of my 12 dogs, it's their first race ever. Yay!
The Healy-based musher was a little nervous, but excited to get out on the trail.
I'm just focused on finishing and having a good time, because I have some yearlings on the team, and well, the whole team is young in general, but yeah, I just want to show them a really good time.
Another rookie, 23-year-old Meredith Mapes, was having a good time until her sled broke about 100 miles in.
This whole stretch from Sourdough to here, there's a lot of tussocks, and the sled would just bounce off of them really hard. And then we started winding in through the trees and hitting some more of that fun stuff.
She tried to keep going after the back part came undone, but didn't make it very far.
6/10 of a mile, according to my GPS, and the whole front end of the sled just fell apart.
She huddled into her sleeping bag beside the trail until she was picked up by race officials. At the front of the pack, things were moving faster. On Sunday evening, Nicholas Petit ate caribou stew at the fire station in Tulsona. He'd been running in first place for roughly 150 miles. With other mushers hot on his heels, he was ready for an exciting finish.
I'm not really worried. I'm more wondering who it is that has about the same pace.
The 300-mile race finishes in Glen Allen. In Mendeltna, I'm Molly Reddig.
With the state in a recession, Many are searching for economic signs of what's in store for 2017. On Friday, inside a packed ballroom at a hotel in downtown Anchorage, members of the business and real estate industries gathered to hear the forecast for Alaska's largest city. The event was hosted by Building Owners and Managers Association, or BOMA. The theme from just about every speaker was that for Anchorage, the economic news is not as bad as many expected. Employment is down, but not too dramatically. State economist Neil Fried told the audience that in the last year, Alaska shed 3,200 jobs, a little over 2%. Fried thinks 2017 will continue to see employment declines, but at a slower pace.
This is my forecast. I'm predicting that the number of jobs in Anchorage will fall again in 2017 by 1.8%. In numbers, it's about 2,800. We feel that we're going to probably lose fewer jobs in some of those basic sectors like oil and gas, but the losses of those jobs from last year are going to spread more into our secondary sectors.
Those include retail, hospitality, construction, and support services. But unlike past eras, Fried says, Anchorage's economy is better diversified and able to withstand the oil price slump. And importantly for both home and commercial property owners, Fried says Anchorage doesn't have a real estate bubble.
This current recession really has very little to do with real estate. It's nothing like the 1980s.
While expensive homes and top quality commercial properties are not selling or leasing as quickly, speakers stress that the data shows relative stability across much of the market. Other speakers at the event touched on development and commercial real estate in Anchorage. They highlighted new construction projects and national chains slated to move in, although they acknowledge the pace has slowed from recent years. One bright spot for the state is an influx of defense dollars in support of the F-35 program slated for Eielson Air Force Base. The event's last speaker, Ted Jensen, summed up the general sentiments when he told the crowd that the sky's not falling. And in fact, for those planning on being in Anchorage for a while, there are some good deals to be found. On Thursday, the Department of Labor released its 2016 report on population change in Alaska. The population has grown slightly because of births, but people are still moving out faster than they are moving in. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more.
Alaska's net migration, or the number of people coming to the state minus those leaving, has been on the decline for the last 6 years. State economist Neil Fried says not all of the outflow has to do with Alaska's recent economic downturns.
You know, this net out-migration started 3 or 4 years ago, and at that time, our economy was still doing relatively well. The change that occurred was that the national economy started to do very well.
Fried says areas like the Pacific Northwest, which he called economically hot right now, often supply the largest numbers for in-migration for Alaska. Since most of the lower 48 is recovering from the recession, job numbers are looking better, and the current economic state of Alaska pales in contrast. Despite the years-long trend of decreases in net migration for the state as a whole, Alaska's population increased over the last year. According to Alaska's Department of Labor and Workforce Development, the state's population went up by more than 2,600 people last year, mostly because there were almost 7,000 more births than deaths. Most of the population increases were in the Anchorage and Mat-Su areas.
New developments of folks living out there in the last, for the last 20 years, and this year is no exception.
That's state demographer Eddie Hunsinger. Hunsinger says Southeast Alaska was the area that saw the largest population losses, in part due to deaths.
Yes, yeah, Southeast Alaska does have an older population, and that's not something particularly new, but that sort of older population goes along with some population losses for Southeast Alaska.
Both Hunsinger and Fried say that last year's numbers, despite some population variances, are pretty much in line with typical natural growth and migration patterns. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering Sally Smith, a Yupik woman known for her work in developing the Alaska tribal health care system.
I pity the poor fool who ever mistook her kindness for a lack of strength or a lack of resolve to do what was right for Alaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
A Yupik woman from the Bristol Bay region, known as an architect of the Alaska tribal health system and a savvy national advocate, died last Tuesday. For nearly 50 years, Sally Smith worked for better health for Alaska Natives and other Native Americans and changed healthcare in Alaska in the process. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Sally Smith was a petite woman who showed up to meetings early and well-prepared and stylishly dressed and groomed, even after a red-eye back from Washington, D.C., where she testified before Congress and went to countless meetings, working to improve health services to Alaska Natives and other Native Americans. Valerie Davidson is Alaska Health and Human Services Commissioner.
She was a national force. I mean, she served as chair of the National Indian Health Board. She met with the numerous secretaries of Health and Human Services, many presidents, many heads of the Centers for Disease Control, heads of the National Institutes of Health.
Davidson says Smith kept the long-term needs of her people foremost in her mind, and that made her a fierce advocate.
I pity the poor fool who ever mistook her kindness for a lack of strength or a lack of resolve to do what was right for Alaska.
Starting in the 1970s and continuing into the 90s, the Indian Health Service shifted management of health services in Alaska to tribal management. During that shift, Smith served often as chairperson on the boards of the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation, Alaska Native Medical Center, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, the Alaska Native Health Board, and the National Indian Health Board. Lincoln Bean of CAKE served alongside Smith on several of those boards. He says the details of the transfer were painstakingly worked out.
That took 2 years of work, 17 hours a day. It is the largest undertaking of its kind in the United States. And she was a great part of that.
Verne Berner is president and CEO of the Alaska Native Health Board.
The breadth and depth of her knowledge was phenomenal.
Berner says Smith's contributions were not just her expertise on self-governance, health, and community engagement, but the tone she set.
She had great listening capacity, starting everything with a level of respect for one another, just really opened her mind to hearing the positions of others, and then therefore being able to respectfully address differing positions.
Davidson says Smith was one of a group of tribal health leaders who set ground rules for negotiations, rules such as work toward consensus with transparency, and when working with outside entities, put the Alaska tribal health system first.
That really serves Alaska well, and tribes in Alaska work together really, really well. Better, in my opinion, way better than other tribes in other states do.
Rather than compete with each other for a limited number of federal grants for self-governance, Alaska tribes applied as one group. They continue to compact as a group. Alaska now is the only state where tribes operate almost the entire Indian Health Service healthcare delivery system. Bean says with the transfer came access to new sources of funding, bringing hundreds of millions of dollars into the tribal health system.
When we assumed the responsibility, we collected third-party billing, Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance.
Indian Health Service funding now covers less than half the cost of providing health services to Alaska Natives. Taking over management of health services allowed tribes to create innovative programs, manage budgets, and hire specialists to target diabetes, cancer, and other health needs of Alaska Natives. Davidson was a teenager when she met Smith. She says Smith took her and many others under her wing.
She is one of the greatest leaders I've ever met in my life. And many of us, quite frankly, would not be in the positions we are today without her incredible mentorship. And she will be missed dearly forever.
Smith has been honored with awards from the National Indian Health Board, Alaska Federation of Natives, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and Healthy Alaska Natives Foundation. Sally Smith is the mother of four sons. She died of leukemia January 10th. The family is planning to hold services in Anchorage on January 20th and in Dillingham on January 22nd. Sally Smith was 70 years old. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn S.
A new Anchorage greenhouse is sprouting more than seeds. It's helping young people develop life skills and improve their mental health. Anchorage Community Mental Health Services recently began the new program, Seeds of Change. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman took a tour.
19-year-old Quavon Bracken walks through rows and rows of tall, dangling racks of hydroponic growing tubes. Green vegetables and herbs are just starting to poke out through slits in the sides.
My favorite over here is the Jericho romaine. They're really green right now.
Their growth is spurred by powerful LED lights that sway back and forth in front of the plants. When the lights switch on, it's so bright, you gotta wear shades. Bracken started working with Seeds of Change a few weeks ago. Most of the time, he's a peer outreach worker with Alaska Youth Advocates. Their teen center is now located in the same building as the greenhouse, and the youth workers are helping get the project up and running. Bracken says he's been interested in agriculture for a while, and he hopes to work on a farm in Israel sometime soon. In the meantime, working with Seeds of Change is giving him the chance to learn about tending plants, what nutrients they need, how much light. Soon, he'll be helping sell the produce at local farmers markets and to restaurants. But the experience is having a deeper impact, too.
I feel like kind of at peace. I can plant some seeds and then, you know, think about something that challenges me in life and then just, you know, go on planting the seeds. And I just feel like I can think a little bit more around it. Probably all the oxygen that's, like, being emitted from them.
And those are some of the ideas behind the new, nearly $3 million project.
That sense of being responsible for, you know, life and nurturing it is a really powerful thing.
That's Mike Sobosinski, the Chief Operating Officer at Anchorage Community Mental Health Services. He explains the program is targeting young people who have been involved with foster care, juvenile justice, and mental health programs.
We tend to look at these youth as at risk. And what we're doing here is we're looking at them as that promise. And so you give them the opportunity and you have expectations that they're going to be able to be responsible and you support them along the way. And it really does a lot for your mental health.
The program supplements on-the-job training with life skills lessons too. Apartment hunting, resume building. They'll employ up to 20 youth at a time for about 6 to 9 months each. It's a transitional program to help the young people get started. Seeds of Change was 15 years in the making. Sobosinski began developing the project well before starting his current post. But he says it was hard to find the money and the space to actually pull it off.
I like to tell everybody that every community mental health center should own a 10,000-foot greenhouse.
But they don't. The greenhouse can produce up to 50 tons of fresh produce per year. Most will be sold to fund the project. It should be self-sustaining by the end of the year. A portion will be donated to people in need. Quavon Bracken says he's excited to see the first harvest.
Like, I really want to, like, go ahead and, like, slice them down, you know, and I want to see them all piled up in one area and see the massive amount that we're going to have, especially for, like, you know, my favorite right there, the romaine Jericho.
The plants should be ready to pick in 4 to 5 weeks. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the 2017 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms available at bpteachers.com.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at AlaskaQuitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Dog mushing has seen a lot of change in the Bristol Bay region. It's been a few years since communities like Dillingham, New Stoyahawk, Eckwok, or Kaliganik have been able to host races. KDLG's Avery Lill talked to local mushers about why fewer people are keeping dogs in the area.
You can hear the dog yards in New Stoyahawk before you can see them. Dozens of canines howl, excited by the sound of a snow machine pulling up to the kennel.
Dozer, and here's Lady, Angel, Muckluck, and Yana, Penny, Ginger.
John Hansen Jr. is one of four dog mushers in New Stoyahawk, probably the most active mushing community in a region that has watched participation in the tradition dwindle.
These other mushers are elderly mushers, and they were in it for 40, 50, 60 years or more. And I don't see any young mushers around in the Bristol Bay region, getting involved in dog mushing.
Part of the reason, he tells me, is dogs take a lot of work. Hansen collects food scraps from neighbors every day. The aroma of fish and moose guts in the steel drum where he cooks the dog's food is pungent. When there's snow, he runs the dogs on a sled. When there isn't, the dogs pull him on a four-wheeler. The recent lack of good snow has been the other main problem for mushers.
They say more snow a long time ago. You know, they talk about lots of snow and colder.
For Hansen, caring for dogs is a full-time job. He lives on money from sponsors and dividend checks from the state's permanent fund and Native Corporation. But it's an uncertain income. This year, Hansen has struggled to find sponsors in the area. It's been a few years since weather has allowed a race in Bristol Bay, and he's not optimistic that this year will be any better. Without races, people and business in the area are less interested in sponsoring local mushers. So he looks to other parts of Alaska, like the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, to sponsor his team and his travel to their races. He'll be traveling to the Kuskokwim, where he says not only are there plenty of races, but interest is growing. Local mushers say that the sport has been on the decline in Bristol Bay well before the years of light snow. Kyle Bleck keeps three old mushing dogs in Dillingham. His dogs might be 12 years old, but they still love to pull. As they cut their way through the frosty tundra, he says he feels at home with his dogs, outside of a snow machine's bubble of noise and exhaust. Bleck has run a few races, but he says he started keeping dogs more for the history of it. He likes the idea that before it was a sport, many families in the area kept dogs as draft animals for travel and hauling.
You know, everybody had dogs because that's what they had to have. That's how they got around. That's how they hauled wood. That's how they went hunting. That's how they traveled. That's how they did everything. You know, when I was growing up here in the, 70s and 80s and 90s, there were dog yards all over the place.
Better roads and more snow machines turned dog sledding into more of a hobby than a necessity. Bleck also believes that the decline can be attributed to a time in the 70s when people first began importing dogs for racing.
When guys first started importing dogs, they imported all the other things that came with dogs, and among that was disease. And so there were massive die-offs in the villages. Some guys lost their entire genetic line to parvo and distemper. That sort of coincided with snow machines becoming available. And that double whammy really, really hit things hard.
Dog teams might be louder, messier, and more time-consuming than snow machines, and you can't throw a tarp on them when the snow melts. But Hansen and Bleck are among a dozen or so holdouts working to keep the tradition alive in Bristol Bay. If Mother Nature cooperates and Dillingham is able to host their annual race at the Spring Beaver Roundup, some younger residents could be inspired to step onto sleds of their own. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
The last person John McPhee talks to in his book, Coming Into the Country, is a young man who calls himself River Wind. At the time, River Wind was 32 years old, about to head down the Yukon in a 15-foot aluminum canoe to find a place to live. 40 years later, he goes by his given name, David Kornberg, and spends most of the year in Fairbanks. Kornberg says he went by River Wind at the time in an attempt to wipe away every trace of civilization as he began his adventure in the country. He says he met McPhee in Eagle after he went to see the postmaster looking for maps.
He said, there's a writer in town. He's got a stack of maps like this. And he showed me two fingers and it looked like it was about an inch thick. And I said, so where is he? What does he look like? And he said, oh, he's renting a cabin down there. And he's a kind of stocky guy with a big dark beard. And I said, okay, thanks. So I walked out on the street, turned, and there about, I don't know, a couple hundred feet down the street was a guy who just fit the description. So I walked down and asked him if he was John McPhee. And he said, yeah. And I said, I heard you got maps. And he said, I do. And I said, can I take a look at him? He said, yeah. And so then we stood and talked for a bit, and I guess he remembered more than I did, because some of the stuff that I told him about wintering over in Haines and so forth made it into the book in that last passage. And so I thanked him, and that was the last I ever saw of him. Okay, so moving on to 1984, I was in Fairbanks, Alaska. I'd met a family, and they asked me if I wanted a house sit. And so I said, sure. I remember one day just kind of wandering around the house. So I went over to a bookshelf and looked through the books. And there was a book that said, Coming Into the Country. I thought, oh, I wonder what that's about. And I looked at it and said, sure enough, it's about Alaska. So then I'm reading through the book and I'm getting farther and farther. And I said, this is really starting to sound familiar. And I don't know why it's sounding so familiar. And I'm getting closer and closer. When I come to this character, I think, wow, that's me. And I read all the way through to the end and just kind of walked around with a big smile on my face, kind of just with my mind nicely blown. And that was when I realized that I'd gotten into his book. I thought his description was very, very good. No, I didn't feel any exaggeration in it. I didn't feel like he had to embellish. He just pretty much took a literary photograph of me and wrote it down. And when I thought back on it, I thought, yeah, it's very appropriate because I was coming into the country. That's exactly what I was doing.
David Kornberg lives in Fairbanks. He's featured as River Wind in the last few pages of John McPhee's book, Coming Into the Country, which was published 40 years ago. Alaska's Energy Desk is celebrating the anniversary of the book with a series of interviews, stories, and public forums this month. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Molly Reddick in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes, Jacqueline Estes, Annie Fite, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, and Avery Lill in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The University of Alaska Southeast is open for business to all Alaskans. 2017 is your year to finish a degree and increase your earning power with online courses in business, accounting, and management. Explore the options online at uas.alaska.edu/SOM. This message sponsored by UAS.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.